This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, from Aslan to Ananda, religious allegory in speculative fiction.
Now, this is a slightly dangerous topic.
Yes, we're obviously not going to go into this trying to offend any particular, or any, actually, organised religion. A little slip there. Obviously, we have our own personal beliefs, or lack thereof. And really, we're just looking at how it's portrayed in speculative fiction, and when it works and when it doesn't, and when the author's advocated an agenda, and when it's just there as part of the flavour, really.
Yes. And I think the idea for this episode actually came, I'm just going to jump right in. I am currently reading a book of short stories called Stories of Your Life and Others by Ted Chiang. I think that's how you pronounce his name. Have you ever heard of this?
I haven't, no.
Well, apparently it's now the major film Arrival starring Amy Adams.
I've seen the film. I didn't realise it was from a book.
Maybe there's a short story. I haven't finished reading the book yet, but I've read the first short story, and I presume I've heard excellent things about the others. But the first one was quite interesting because it actually told. I mean, one thing I really liked was that I used to actually be really, really good in RE because I actually really liked the Bible stories. They were kind of. I memorized quite a few of them. I sort of knew them quite well. And one of my favorites, one that I liked, was The Tower of Babylon.
Yeah.
And the first story is, it's not actually specifically said as Christian, but it's about this tower, the Tower of Babylon, which is being built. And it's being built so that they can actually reach the vault of heaven.
Do you mean the Tower of Babel?
Babel, yes. Yeah, the Tower of Babel. I do mean the Tower of Babel, but Babylon is also a place. So this is it was drawing on that. There's a lot of the same kind of imagery, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
This humongous tower that's been built, and the story begins where basically miners are being sent up to the... Miners as in people who mine things, not young children. though there are young children up there as well, people who are living on this tower, because it takes, like... It's as big as a mountain. It takes, like, 4 months to sort of get to the top, or, you know, it takes a really, really long time. And these miners are being sent up to the top to mine through the vault of heaven because they've reached the top of the sky. And that one of the miners, kind of as he's going up, he has this dilemma within himself, which is that, is this what God wants? The idea is that that man had explored all the corners of the earth and they'd kind of gotten a little bit bored, and so they kind of wanted to go and explore the world of God and also give him access to be able to come down and look at their world. But he's going up thinking, actually, is this really, if God wanted us to do this, wouldn't he have just built a staircase or something like that? But then nothing has happened to stop them building the tower, so he doesn't really know whether it's right or not. And it was a really, really interesting story, because I kept expecting the tower to fall down like it did with the Tower of Babel, but it doesn't. And there's quite an interesting sort of switch at the end, which I won't spoil, because I actually... I'm quite enjoying this, and I don't know whether I can recommend it yet, but I certainly liked the originality of the first story.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. I have to say, the actual Bible story, The Tower of Babel, was one that made me feel intensely uncomfortable as a child.
And why is that?
I think that's because it is, as you say, in that particular short story, where mankind has dominion over the earth. And everybody works together to build this tower up to God, because they're fed up of God just coming down whenever it suits them. Because if you read the Old Testament, sort of Genesis, etc., he walks amongst man, known as the Ancient of Days. So, you know, he was kind of regularly visited, as it were, came down and visited with them. And they wanted access. They believed that as God's children, as it were, they were now capable of ascending to the same heights as God.
Yeah.
And obviously God didn't like this very much, so God divided them by giving them lots of different languages, so they didn't speak each other's language anymore, so they couldn't communicate, and therefore they couldn't
work together.
Actually build the tower and work together, as you say, and they had wars.
Yeah. It's when you put it like that, Jules, I guess I liked the idea. I'm always really interested in stories which explain why things are the way they are, you know?
Yeah.
And I quite like the answer. Why are there so many languages in the world? Well, it was because at one point humans got above their station, and so God divided them. Yeah, and now you explain it, it does feel kind of vaguely malicious. But I really, really like this idea that this was the birth of languages, and that kind of explains it. And this story, it's the reason that I sort of bring it up, and the reason it kind of really inspired me was because it doesn't actually have anything to do with the Tower of Babel at all. Only in the idea where man decides to all build something together.
Yeah.
But in this, people are already divided. They all come from different places. I don't know whether any of them speak different languages, but they all come from different places already. And it's, I've never really seen a Bible story used in that kind of way, because I've seen books which are retellings of Bible stories. I've seen things like that, but I've never ever seen the Bible used as a source of inspiration, not in any God kind of way, but just as a source of inspiration via the stories themselves.
Yeah, and that is good. I have seen a few examples, but as you say, they're a bit fewer and far between, but certainly the anthologies produced by the Random Writers, which I'm a part mm-hmm. of, and so are you, in the first two anthologies, we've got a couple of examples of that, actually. There's a story called Samsara by my friend Karen Jinane, and it's like a retelling of Samson and Delilah, but it's shifted and put in a dystopian future, and it is literally just used as a source of inspiration, and it's very, very clever.
Ah,
and it's a gender bent story as well. So Samson is actually female, and Delilah is a male hairstylist. It's really, really good.
I see. There we go. There's lots and lots of stories which have got from the Bible, which, if you step away from the religious side of it, and you look at the stories themselves, there are some brilliant stories in the Bible which are brilliant as stories. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a half-written sci-fi one I've done called The Snake and the Apple, which is about but it's all to do, it's sci-fi, genetic engineering. I won't go into too much detail because I might actually finish it someday. But yeah, it's taken from the Garden of Eden and this idea that there's this creative, superior species that was basically growing us for spare body parts. but yeah, the actual Bible stories themselves are a great source of inspiration.
I think one of the main problems with drawing from the Old Testament or from the Bible in general as a source of inspiration and material is that unless you are prepared to deal with it as religious and Christian content, people can get scared away. They don't want to be disrespectful. They don't want to be using something and then not addressing the religious element that goes along with it.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that. The thing to remember with the Abrahamic traditions is that they share a lot of their, I'm going to use the word mythology, but you know what? I'm a pagan and I use pagan mythology as well. So
yeah,
I don't expect everyone else to embrace my personal beliefs. But yeah. You're right, there is an element there of not wanting to upset anyone, and that's a good thing, but I think there comes a point where you do have to just look at the story and say, is it allegorical? Is there a historical element? Can you divide those things up? And either way, is it a good story and can you learn something from it? In which case, then it should be open for interpretation.
Well, I mean, if you look at other kind of religions, especially the sort of the pagan ones, if we look at how we draw from mythology, to create stories and fairy tales and things along those lines. They're much the same thing. And I think it's because the Abrahamic religions are so widespread and they are so large that, again, yeah, people are worried about drawing from it unless it's going to be a Christian story. So unless they are kind of looking at God in some way or another.
Obviously, that is, there's a tiny bit of irony there when people say, you know, it's a Christian story, because obviously they weren't originally, they were Judaic in origin, most of them.
Yeah.
There's a lovely bit in Ivanhoe where the head of the Inquisition is prosecuting Rebecca, who is a Jewess, and he's going to have her burnt at the stake for being a heretic, for not being a Christian, basically. And she starts praying. She starts using what he considers Christian prayers, and he criticizes her for it and says it proves that she's a heretic because she's taking his faith out of context. Assistant Inquisition guy says, in all fairness, they were her prayers before they were ours. Which doesn't earn him a lot of brownie points, of course.
No, I can't imagine it does, but it's true. It's true. It all stemmed from somewhere. I read, I think possibly one of my favourite, and I think this is the same for a lot of people, two of my favourite sort of stories from the Old Testament are Moses and Joseph.
Yeah.
And I really, really like that, you know, I was in Joseph and His Technicolor Dreamcoat when I was younger. I got to be in the musical. It was great fun. And I was also in a musical about Moses, so there you go. Missionary school. All of our plays were Christian-based.
I know that feeling.
In fact, I once played Jesus Christ. I got to stand up for like 15 minutes with my being crucified. I was crucified. And they decided not to put me in a little sort of loincloth thing, so I was wearing my karate gi. They felt that it was, yeah, whatever. Anyway, the point is, I really, really like the Joseph story. I always thought it was a great one. I recently read The Red Tent. Have you read it?
Yes, a long time ago. It's about Dinah, is that right?
Yes. Dinah, I don't actually know.
It is pronounced Dinah.
Dinah, yeah. And who is the sister, the one daughter born of, it was Jacob, wasn't it?
Yeah, Jacob's. Yeah.
Jacob's his two wives and then his many children.
I reckon he had a lot more wives and concubines than that, but yes, go on.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, the story is that he had two wives, in the book as well, he has two wives and two concubines. This is pretty standard in that time. And therefore he had a lot and a lot of sons. But the story is that he actually, from the woman he loved, he only ever had two sons. And it was interesting because I feel that the book is very well researched and very, because the Bible is, oddly enough, quite male-centered. Don't think anyone's really surprised by that. The stories are very male-centered. And within the Bible, there is a footnote about the rape of Dinah, which is never really addressed again. And this is her story, and about who she was and about who the rest of them really were and what was going on. And I found it incredibly moving. And actually, another thing I really liked about it was that it was the first time I'd ever read sort of Christian fiction where the focus wasn't really on religion. And it was also the first time I read something where in the book, Dinah falls in love with an Egyptian prince. I believe it's an Egyptian prince.
I think so. I have, as I said, it, you know, it's probably about 20 years ago. So
yeah, well, he's an Egyptian and he's a royal of some kind. She falls in love with him, and they decide to get married, and it's not really approved by Jacob, but he basically says, right, that's fine. If you accept my religion, you may have her as your bride, but you must, all the men in the area must be circumcised. because that's the Jewish tradition. So they all said, okay. And they all got circumcised. And while they were recovering, two of the brothers came in and slaughtered all the men who were obviously recovering from being circumcised as grown men, and sort of dragged the sister back, Dinah back. And there's a very powerful moment where Dinah addresses her father, but she addresses him, and there's this idea that actually God is speaking through her, and she basically curses him. You know, she says that from now on, the name of your God will be a curse. People will insult you. You'll never find peace. Everything is going to go to hell. And then she leaves. And as per what she says, and as per the story, everything does go to hell. Lots and lots of awful things happen. And he loses the wife that he loved, and he loses his favorite son. But again, it was the first time I'd ever seen Christian fiction done like that. And I really, really liked it because it put a whole new perspective to a story which has been retold many, many, many times. There was as well as Joseph's Technicolor Dreamcoat, there was also a DreamWorks movie.
Yeah, I think, no, I didn't see that. I saw The Prince of Egypt, which is the Moses one.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about The Prince of Egypt later, because I think that's a really good topic of conversation. But there was Joseph, King of Dreams. That was what the other one was. Same kind of animation style, very beautifully done. But again, with a very, very soft focus on what these characters were like.
Yeah.
Instead of the reality of what a male, the very male-centered, two wives, two concubines. You know, they didn't really show the unevenness of what was happening and then the severity of some of the things that did happen. Because the Old Testament is actually pretty gritty.
Yeah, it definitely is. It contains such gems as, and you will slaughter them down to the last man, woman, and child, for example.
Exactly. It's pretty gritty stuff. So it was, and admittedly, I don't read a lot of Christian fiction, but it was the first time I'd ever seen something which actually acknowledged that grittiness and acknowledged in a very historical way what the world was like and what people's lives were like.
Yeah. The one thing I would say about the Old Testament is, of course, that really what we have access to today is what was decided was suitable for common consumption by the Council of Nicaea.
Yes.
And Emperor Constantine. And a lot of it has been taken out and it's basically neutered. And it is, you know, if you read the Bible with the Apocrypha, it reads very, very differently. Women are not quite the second class citizens. There are stories that were passed on by women teachers, women rabbis, who did exist. They perhaps weren't as common, but there were plenty of them. Within the system, they were kind of teaching other women how to game the system.
Yeah.
You know, there were things that were not so great, but within the system, they found ways of making it work for them as well. There was status for them. Things like, I mean, unfortunately, the Council of Nicaea took things like the story of Jezebel, who was the Queen of Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a great warrior queen who kept off the Israelites for a really, really long time. She was betrayed by one of her lovers, I think, and the Israelites sort of overtook Babylon, and she was thrown down from her tower to be fed on by dogs. Now, how accurate that was to the original story, I don't know, because it was passed down in oral tradition. They may well have done that, but she wasn't the whore of Babylon as she's depicted as being. She was just a woman who was in control of her own destiny. So,
Jezebel!
So, you know, exactly. And it's become synonymous with a woman who's a bit loose in her morals or, you know, has negotiable virtue, as it were.
Yeah. And again, another example is not in the Old Testament, but in the New Testament, Mary Magdalene, who is depicted as a whore, but in all likelihood was probably a priestess.
And a wife.
Yeah.
There is actually a lot of evidence that she was, in fact, Jesus' wife.
Yeah, that it's a different kettle of fish.
Well, I'm not going to go all Holy Blood, Holy Grail, but, you know, if we're talking about the Bible, we should talk about the entire Bible, not just the bit the Council of Nicaea thought was, you know, suitable for everyone to read.
Yeah, this is true. Yes, there is lots of discussion about the role of Mary Magdalene and who she was. And yeah, there is evidence that supports the idea that she might have been married to Jesus in a historical evidence. I mean, historically, Jesus was actually a person. We know this.
Yes. And there is as much historical evidence to say that, you know, he was married and had children and then got divorced, quite probably.
Yeah.
Which you can understand why certain religious groups would find that problematic.
But yeah, it is very doctored. The idea that the Bible has been reworked many, many, many times to fit certain agendas, certain times. I mean, I've mentioned this before, but hell didn't exist until the medieval era as a concept.
Yeah, and even then it wasn't to be burnt forever. It was a case of to live without the sight of God. So it meant living outside the system, as it were, which was considered punishment. But
exactly. But but this is the other thing, is that people are like, oh yeah, well, if you don't behave, there's this thing called hell. Where do they get hell from? Norse mythology.
Yeah. Which, in fairness, if you read about the realm of hell and the goddess of the same name in Norse mm-hmm. mythology, that doesn't sound great, to be honest.
No.
It's not being burnt to death for eternity, but it's not great.
No, it isn't. But then even the image of burning and stuff like that, you're again drawing on Hades and on the underworld. Again, it's this drawing on of other religions to create this imagery.
Yeah, but even with Hades, it's only one very small part of Hades that has anything to do with fire, and that's Tartarus.
Exactly.
The rest of it is all just unbecoming and just forgetting who you are. And there's a few beasties and things as well, in fact.
Yeah. It's monsters and dogs and... But yeah, it's, again, this is something that appeared much later, and the Bible has changed depending on certain agendas and certain times, because it's put together and it's decided by certain people.
Yeah, ultimately the Bible itself was a political tool. It was a tool for political agenda. And if you think about how many different versions of the Bible we've got, even now, I mean,
yeah.
There's the King James Version, which, you know, have this gorgeous Jacobean prose, which, you know, is really resonant if you're saying it aloud. And there's the Roman Catholic Bible, which is a little bit more closed in and a bit sort of elitist. Or you can read something for the Baptists. You can read something with Calvinistic doctrine of the elite. And all of them read slightly differently. It's like the synoptic gospels, you know, Matthew, Mark and Luke. I mean, John's a little bit different. It's not really a synoptic gospel. But they're all telling the same stories, but they're telling them from the perspective of the people they're trying to influence or get on board.
Yeah. There's another element to another level of stories within the Bible, and that's parables.
Yes.
And I like the idea that we learn parables, but we learn that they're stories within stories, if that makes sense. And the idea that perhaps there are parts of the Bible which are all were essentially meant to be parables during the time. Are these things to be taken literally, or are these things to be taken as a lesson?
Yeah, I mean, the parables themselves were the teachings of Jesus.
Yeah.
And it was how to get a largely uneducated population basically embracing a doctrine of being good to each other.
Yeah.
Rather than a rather spiteful outlook of, well, you've harmed me, so I'm going to do something to you. In a political climate that was extremely pressured and was, you know, pretty close to exploding, which it did, obviously, in a war that the Jews could never ever win against the Romans, and obviously they didn't after Jesus died, quite some years after. They were just absolutely slaughtered when they finally went to war.
Yeah.
It was terrible. So he was kind of saying, you know what? We can all live like this, and this actually isn't as bad as you think it is. You're so fixated on us being our own state and our own freedom, this is actually probably the best we can do at the moment because we are massively outgunned. But that's not a popular opinion. And as an educated and political figure, and there's more to that obviously as well, he was kind of saying in a way that people who were uneducated could understand that they were better to probably follow his lead. So, but I have to say, years later, I look at the actual parables and think, well, that's kind of patronising. I can see what you're getting at, but it's kind of patronising. It's like the Good Shepherd. It's like, yeah, that's a lovely story until you think about the fact that all of you are sheep.
Yep.
So there is historical context involved as well. And I always felt that the story of the prodigal son, and it's like, well, the prodigal son just basically gets everything and gets welcomed back by his father. And what about the good brother who did everything right the whole time and was a dutiful son? Well, he just gets ignored. Do you not feel a bit bad for the good son?
I do feel bad for the good son. I do. I also, the Adam and Eve one is interesting, because it's an entire story which is the promotion of ignorance, which is the total opposite of what we try and promote nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at it as a creation myth, it's okay. It probably is about the same as most creation myths.
Yeah, but it's this idea, and again, you see it in the Roman mythology as well, with Zeus and Pandora and stuff like that. But it's the punishment of curiosity. It's the punishment for the pursuit of knowledge, for the pursuit of more. And it's about saying, stick to what you're told.
I wonder a little bit whether how much of that isn't just shifted in translation, because obviously it wasn't written down originally, and then when it was written down, it was in Coptic Sanskrit, which was translated to Greek, which was mistranslated in Latin, and was then later mistranslated during the time of Henry VIII into English.
Yeah,
and but I think quite a lot was, I think the just a tiny bit of emphasis was changed, and I don't think it was necessarily punishment. I think it was more a case of, okay, if you want to be like God and you want that sort of knowledge, it comes with consequence, and here is the consequence. You can't live innocently anymore.
No, but see, that's the thing. I think that actually, and I agree, that it may very well have been due to doctoring and translation and stuff like that, but I really do think that, again, the people who were doing this were doing the same thing, which was that they were telling a mass of often hungry, unhappy people that they shouldn't overstep their boundaries, because if they did, there would be punishment. It was God's will that they just had faith. They didn't question. They didn't try and improve things for themselves. They stayed within the system that was built for them.
I think that's the thing, though, because there is a big difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament. The Old Testament tells you what allegedly did happen, and the New Testament tells you how you should go about things from there on.
Yeah.
So I think a lot more of the New Testament is about control, whereas the Old Testament is kind of like, well, this happened and you can't prove it didn't because it was hundreds of years ago, etc.
Yeah.
So there's different emphasis. And I think because the Old Testament had been established for that long, an oral tradition is actually quite accurate.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we do know that, you know, the very first line of the Bible is actually mistranslated. It says, in the beginning there was God. Well, actually, that's not what the first line of the Bible is supposed to say. If you look at it in the original Greek, translated from the Coptic Sanskrit, it is actually, in the beginning there was the Word. But the Word is, again, misattributed. What it means is consciousness. So this is, in the beginning there was consciousness. There's no mention of a creator God at all.
You're blowing my mind, Jules.
I did quite a lot of research on this years ago. It's all coming back to me.
But I think the point that I'm trying to get to is that there are certain parts of the Bible, whether due to mistranslation or not, just aren't really viable to be drawn in stories at the moment, because a lot of what fiction is trying to tell, a big trend that you see in fiction at the moment, is one of intelligence is sexy. You know what I mean? Pushing, looking for, fighting, equality. These are main, a lot of themes that you're seeing at the moment in fiction.
Yeah, I would agree with that, but I would say there's also an awful lot of those themes in the New Testament as well.
No, I tend to agree, but that's my point, is that there are parts of the Bible now which you can't really draw on unless you reanalyze it, just like in The Red Tent.
Yeah, no, you definitely would need to reanalyze them, otherwise you wouldn't have a modern audience who wanted to read them.
Yeah. Moving on, I said I'd talk about the Prince of Egypt. Now, I think that that's, it's a fantastic film. Have you watched it? You have?
Yeah, I didn't particularly like it, as I recall.
Oh, well, how come?
Well, I think when I saw it, I must have been about 15.
Mm-hmm.
And I was feeling very sceptical about the Bible in general, so that might have coloured my opinion.
Mm,
it was obviously
enough.
Beautifully animated and immoderately accurate with the original Bible story, which I knew very well back then.
Mm-hmm.
Probably less well now, because I don't need to know it quite as well. But I, as a child, I did actually read the Bible from absolute beginning to end in about 3 different versions. So there was a time when I was very familiar with all the Bible stories, including the less known ones that probably weren't child-friendly. But I always kind of thought Moses was a bit of a dick.
That's fair enough, yes.
And I don't think I've ever really moved away from that. If we had somebody nowadays who sort of came down from a mountain and said, these have been handed down from on high, you must follow me into the desert on faith alone kind of thing, wouldn't you, you'd think, and he managed to get people to follow him, you'd think he was a cult leader or a sociopath of some kind.
Yeah. But the film doesn't look at that bit. The film looks at the bit before. The escape from Egypt. And I mean, I love the story. I really love the story, the plagues and stuff like that. And I like it as well because there was this whole analysis about how it could have been about a volcano eruption, which would have made a lot of sense. And I love looking at the explanations of how these things could have historically happened and how it could have worked in real life.
Yeah.
And as you say, the film has that really fantastical element as well, and is beautifully animated. And actually, another thing I quite like about the film was that when the film was being made, the makers contacted major religious leaders of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism to discuss the film. And all of the major leaders at the end and representatives all agreed that it was handled with dignity, and it was handled really, really well, and they all really agreed with how the film was portrayed. They felt it was very accurate to the story, it was very accurate to the feeling, and that it was dealt with delicately. And I felt that it was multifaceted. Again, very, very friendly view of the kind of person Moses was compared to in the Bible, where, I think there's lots of little things that are obviously missed out. There's an idea that Moses might have actually had a stutter, so he had his brother Aaron with him, who did the talking instead.
Yeah, I mean, it does say that Aaron was with him in the Bible, doesn't it? And you never really find out why, so it's possible.
Yeah, and so there's lots of little things that obviously were kind of removed from it. But as a story, it's a great story. Moving away from all the Christian, like if we look away from the origin, as a film, as a complete film, it's really beautiful.
Yeah, no disputing that. And obviously, the 12 plagues of Egypt is a great story. It's one that really captures children's imagination, the same way of Joseph's brothers selling him into slavery does. The same way the Garden of Eden does, or what were the other ones that really stuck with me? The Tower of Babel again. And...
Yeah, but I really, really feel like there's something about the Moses one, because it doesn't just, it has all of the story. It has the structure of an epic journey. You have a person who flees from his home in disgrace. He comes back to save his people. He faces hardship. Like, it could be an epic novel, if that makes sense.
Well, it's a classic hero's journey, isn't it? I mean,
it is.
He shouldn't have survived his childhood. There's the whole Moses basket incident, for example.
Yeah. So he's got the... It's great. He really is. Because you've got someone who shouldn't have survived childhood. He's an outcast, but he's brought up in royalty. He discovers who he truly is. He's faced with a moral dilemma. He flees, but then finds his true self and finds the strength to come back and face the pharaoh, and he liberates his people. And if you end the story there, ignoring the 40 years in the desert, ignoring the original content, it's a really, really great story.
Well, yeah, I mean, an awful lot of Bible stories aren't they? They're really great stories.
They are really great stories.
Samson and Delilah, there you go, there's another one.
Samson and Delilah is another excellent story. But again, a lot of the Bible stories actually end quite sadly. They mostly die, but the nice thing about the Moses one is, again, ignoring the 40 years in the desert thing, there's a really happy ending there. Just in the same way there's a happy ending in Joseph, where he's there like, I am the brother you lost, ta-da, please come and join me in this land of the plentiful, everything's going to be fine. That's a happy ending.
That's a happy ending, except
until a few years later, they all become slaves.
It's like, it's not, I was kind of thinking, have you read a different version to me?
No, like, you just have to know when to stop reading, Jules.
That was the problem. You see, I read it from cover to cover in several versions. So, and I could never really get over the whole Job thing. I mean, the God of the Old Testament is, I can't actually use the word on Dissecting Dragons, but he is one. Okay, he really is.
So, it's story-wise, there are some really great stories in the Bible which could be used, which could just be stories, you know what I mean? They could literally be stories that if you just took them out of the context.
Yeah. Well, I think this is where I have a bit of a divorce from the proceedings, is the fact that, as far as I'm concerned, they are just stories, because to me they are. Maybe they're not to a Jew or a Christian, and that's fine, that's up to them. But, you know, if you read the Mabinogion, that's just stories to me as well, even though I am a pagan. And you know, if you read them, any of the great lays of the Irish heroes, they're still just stories. I might think that there are personal truths in there, but they are just stories, and they again don't begin and end; they just continue through.
Yeah.
So in exactly the same way.
Yeah. No, that's fair. That's fair. I did see a thing recently, which was just someone. Someone used Google Maps to judge the distance from Egypt to Palestine and how long it would take to walk, and it said like 14 days.
They were really lost. They were just going around in circles.
Well, I mean, these were also nomadic people, so it's not like they were walking every day. They would stop, spend a few weeks in a certain place, and then
create
pick
a golden
up everything.
Cow.
Exactly. and then continue on. So it's not like they just went, right, we're walking there. They were a nomadic people.
Yes. I always liked the story of the Battle of Jericho, which, you know, I was quite a bloodthirsty child, so that's probably why.
Doesn't surprise me.
But no, because I suppose it ticked the same box for me as Thermopylae, for example, mm-hmm. where, I mean, I think they only had about 200 men, not 300 for the Battle of Jericho. But God says to Joshua, no, that's fine. Sound the horns, keep sounding them. And what you're going to do is just keep your men marching around and around Jericho so that they think there's like 10 times as many of you as there actually is.
Which is pretty smart, to be honest.
It's like, okay, God is a trickster. can get on board with this version.
But I mean, there are lots of versions where they do things which are actually quite smart, rather than, you know, they do lots of tricks and things like that.
Yeah, it's like, we're outnumbered, we're outgunned, we only have 200 men, if we include the very young and the very old. And they've got a nice big city with walls and can basically live there for 10 years without a problem. We'll just keep walking around and around the outside so they think it's the same army.
My god, they just keep coming and coming.
It's like, we better open the gates, really. Oh no, the walls have fallen down. Noah's Ark as well, that's one that always captures children's imagination right up until you really look at the story.
Yeah, Noah's Ark is a good one. They're just memorable, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them do hit that archetype, that need for an archetype, that sort of Greek myths, Roman myths, and many of the other sort of more pagan myths and things actually hit for us.
Mm.
So I think that might be part of it.
Well, I mean, yeah, they had that recent film, which was I think it was a flop, I don't know. Emma Watson was in it, and...
Oh, I didn't watch that.
No, neither did I. But that was in it. That they had that. It's right that there are stories that we see again and again and again. And it's a shame, because there are also some stories that we never, ever, ever see. At all. I mean, another really good one is the Good Samaritan, but that, again, that's a parable.
That's the only parable I actually like, I think.
Yeah. It's a nice little parable, actually. And that's used a lot and a lot. And the nice thing is, actually, this is a parable which doesn't really have anything to do with God.
No,
it's to do with the generosity of and the kindness of other people.
It's just being a decent person and seeing someone as human as you, even if they are from a different sect or culture.
Yeah, seeing someone as equal. So that's a good one. But there are some great stories in the Bible which we don't really see at all. The time Jesus met a bunch of dragons, they took that one plain out of the Bible.
It's like the time he charged into battle on a velociraptor as well.
He did that?
Well, allegedly. John the Baptist was his wingman, so. Great stories that aren't in the Bible that are worth going and looking at. For example, there's all the stories about the Nephilim who came down and fell in love with and married human women, mm-hmm. and lost their divine angelic status. In fact, reading about all the angelic stations in the Torah is really fascinating. Mythology, but it is really, really interesting. Did you know there's an angel of sacred prostitution called Namah, for example?
I did not know that. Tell me more.
Well, it's pretty much in the title there. I'm not sure the rest of it is suitable for discussion right now.
No, Jules, I need you to explain it to me.
No. Okay, it's on the understanding that when a man and a woman, mm-hmm. we'll say man and woman for now, but I'm pretty sure it's across gender with whoever. Kind of yep. thing. Copulate. Yes. There comes a point when a man sort of loses everything, you know, right at the very end.
Yes.
And literally in that moment, that's when they're closest to God. That's the understanding. Which is why you had sacred prostitutes called hierodules.
Right.
Which is where you get the word whore from today.
Ah.
And, you know, they were all dead. I say sacred prostitutes, their duty in the temples was to sleep with men who came seeking wisdom through that path. That was a path to wisdom. You know, go have sex with a sacred prostitute. So they weren't selling themselves for coin. They were doing it in a spiritualistic sense, which is obviously really misunderstood later on by Christianity.
Yes, naturally.
Yes, because they were all a bit prudish, or certain sects of them were. It's not fair to say they all were. But anyway, the angel that presided over that was a female angelic being called Namah.
This is fantastic. Thank you for opening my eyes to this.
And there are loads of... Namah had something like, I think it was 9 or 13 angelic followers who are mostly male. But and they were all guardians of certain different types of sexual act. If you want to read a really good book about it, read Cushiel's Dart by Jacqueline Carey. It is a bit BDSM heavy, but it's based on this mythology, and it's set in a sort of alternate France.
Yeah,
called Dungeon.
Check that out. So, what about you? Which Christian book? Well, I guess we should probably mention the Chronicles of Narnia.
Yes. We'll do a bit more modern time. Modern Christian, I say Christian books, but yeah, there are books that have a very Christian theme to them, and obviously the Chronicles of Narnia is one. Yeah. I didn't realise it when I first read the Chronicles of Narnia. Bear in mind, I was about 7 at the time.
Yeah.
So it was only later when someone said, oh yeah, well, you know, the Jesus allegory lion. I'm like, not Aslan, what, really? kind of thing, and felt kind of cheated by the whole thing.
Yeah.
But when you look at it, it's sort of yes and no works. There are parts of it where you feel that C.S. Lewis is really being quite preachy, and other parts where you think he's not just preaching the wholesale ordinary Christianity of his time, he's advocating something a little bit different.
Yeah.
But what I couldn't really forgive him for was in the last battle where they all die, they all go to heaven, kind of. Narnia, mm-hmm. The alternate Narnia is a kind of heaven, except for Susan, who gets left behind because she wanted to grow up and, you know, have sex and things.
Well, that's just rude.
And it's the whole, I mean, Neil Gaiman wrote a story called The Problem of Susan, which is sort of deals with that sort of, oh yeah, everybody goes to heaven except Susan because God forbid she should want to actually grow up and be an adult. Yeah, so, I mean, the Chronicles of Narnia are still highly entertaining, and I think actually if you read them without realising they're Christian allegory, you probably get more out of them, in my opinion.
Yeah. No, I would tend to agree with you actually on that. I think that it wasn't really necessary, but again, it does highlight that we do really like that moralistic good versus evil template.
Yeah, I mean, C.S. Lewis obviously includes a lot from Greek and Roman mythology in them as well.
Yeah.
But he treats them as if they're all lesser gods. And I think what I responded to as a child, because I loved mythology, I thought it was so much more interesting than Christianity. and the fact that they were included and they were treated as real by Aslan, who clearly was the best of the best, apart from the Emperor from over the sea, who we never really see. Who was clearly God and Jesus kind of thing.
Yeah.
Was the fact that they were considered real. They were just lesser divinities. And I think I responded to that. And they're obviously written with a lot of emotional honesty because he actually believes in what he's writing.
Wait, as in you?
No, the Christian message behind them. Right, C.S. Lewis believed in what he was writing.
Oh, okay. For a minute I was a little bit worried about him.
I can't speak for whether he believes in dryads and things or not. He may well have done.
No, I was more worried about him believing that Jesus was a lion man and that Narnia existed. But okay.
To be honest, that wouldn't be the weirdest thing that a Christian's ever believed. Or anyone from any religion, in fairness.
No, true.
That's pretty harmless compared to some things that organised religions believe.
But yeah, to be honest, if you are going to believe anything, you might as well believe in Narnia. It's actually quite nice.
Another set of books that I read much later,
mm-hmm.
By Madeleine L'Engle, which is the Wrinkle in Time series. It's a quartet. There are 4 books. I can't remember the name of the last 2, but it's A Wrinkle in Time and A Swiftly Tilting Planet were the 2 that resonated with me most clearly. And it's about a single family that has a set of quite unusual experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Whereby they time travel and they have in the first one, in A Wrinkle in Time, obviously they're time travelling, but the little boy comes in saying he's found a dragon in the garden. It's not a dragon, it's a cherubim. Cherubims aren't cute little baby type things with blushing rosy cheeks of both kinds. They're actually described in the Bible as being wheels within wheels with hundreds of eyes, and this is what the child has seen in their vegetable patch.
That's fun.
Yeah. It's always worth remembering that within angelic mythology, angels don't look like people at all. They really, really don't. They look more like, you know, dragons, monsters, and structures made of light. So that makes them more interesting, in my opinion.
Just eyes. Lots and lots of eyes.
Yeah, and the little boy's not frightened, but he's like, there's a dragon in the garden. He thinks it's really cool, and then gets sent on a mission.
I mean, there's a story for you, which is that people hunting monsters until they realise they're actually killing angels.
Yeah, potentially. It's something I think that Philip
Pullman... I'm keeping that, by the way.
Help yourself. Something Philip Pullman touched on with his Dark Materials was the fact that, yes, the angels in that look like people because that's what we expect to see, but actually what they really look like is structures made of light. So they look more like buildings. You sound like you're having trouble with that.
No, just trying to imagine it. For some reason, I'm just seeing, like, Notre Dame or something like that, and it's just white, and it's trying to get into a trench coat. I've been watching too much Supernatural. Sorry.
going back to Madeleine L'Engle, because I sort of tripped off there. They are good books. They're good stories. I suppose I always felt a bit uncomfortable with an overly Christian message, because I just generally feel uncomfortable when any author tries to preach at me through a book.
Yeah.
So if someone comes in with a really political feminist agenda, I'm a bit sort of, whoa, hang on, what are you trying to push on me? And yeah. Not necessarily because I disagree with them, but more because it's a case of, I want you to present me with what you think and then let me draw my own conclusions. I don't want you to tell me what to think. Yeah. And unfortunately, I had an awful lot of Christianity shoved down my throat, which has tainted my opinion somewhat. So I am not an unbiased person to talk to about this.
Yep, no, that's fair. And I am actually with you on that said missionary school. So, yeah, it is a hard topic, actually, sometimes. And it can be frightening, because actually there are a lot of stories I like from the Bible and a lot of parts of the Bible that I find interesting and actually I wouldn't mind drawing on. But I don't, the reason I don't is that I don't want to be mistaken for a Christian writer, and I don't want to be dealing with Christianity in that way. I just don't want to be doing it.
Well, I mean, to be honest, if you're drawing on the Old Testament, you probably wouldn't be.
No, I know, but yeah. It would be, I guess the problem is that there's the association. And the moment there's an inch, you know, the moment there's a, yeah, this has got Christian sort of symbolism in it or something like that, then people start reading it as Christian symbolism. Even if all I've done is I've drawn from a kind of a story. I'm not drawing on the morality, I'm not drawing on the religious element, I'm drawing on a story. The moment there's a connection with Christianity, that is how people read it. And I think that that will taint the way that you read something. Whether you read something because you want that, or whether you read something and you didn't want it. Just in the way finding out that the Chronicles of Narnia had a Christian element to it that you weren't aware of before suddenly meant that you didn't enjoy it as much.
It was more a case of that I felt cheated. It wasn't that I didn't enjoy it as much. You know, I felt like someone had snuck something in there. But on the other hand, I was still, to all intents and purposes, a Christian at the time because I was a child.
Yeah.
So it was slightly different. I would still read those books now and I still enjoy them as a story, but I don't have to take on everything that's being said there. I don't know. It is, you're right. I think when someone comes in with an obvious agenda, that's very off-putting, no matter what the agenda is. Having said that, sometimes people will read things into your books which aren't there at all anyway, or, you know, you don't think they're. I know we talk about Harry Potter a lot, but, you know, you had one side of Christianity embracing Harry Potter as a messianic Jesus-type figure, and the other side burning the books because they were of the devil, so...
Yeah, this is true. People do kind of see what they want to see. I guess it's mostly about intention.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Wow, I'm very proud of us. We've managed to deal with this issue. We've managed to have this discussion. And I feel we weren't too biased, don't think.
No, ultimately, I don't have a dog in this fight because I know where my morality lies and where it's originated, and you know, most of my family is Christian of one stripe or another, and I don't have a problem with that, and they respect, or at least outwardly respect, where I come from as well. But it can be very difficult, and I know not everybody has that luxury, so...
Yeah.
You're right. I am always a little bit sort of, okay, well, why are you so offended if someone is just genuinely asking a question? It's not the same as someone saying something that is a religious-centric insult.
Yeah.
Any sort of religion should stand up to robust doubt and questioning, if it's any sort of religion at all.
Well, isn't that the purpose of faith, is that despite that you shouldn't be worried about people questioning, and you shouldn't be worried about looking at evidence and listening to other people's arguments, because you should have your faith even afterwards?
I would go a step further than that, and it was something I read by Anne Bronte. She wrote a lot of sort of ecstatic religious poetry, rather like Thomas Traherne did. Mm-hmm. And both of them had doubt as the cornerstone of their religious faith. They were both Christians, separated by a couple of centuries, but both of them believed very, very strongly that you could not really have faith without the presence of very strong doubt. If you weren't constantly questioning and realigning yourself and making micro adjustments in what you believed, then you didn't really have faith. What you had was this sort of blind need to follow.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. I think true faith, in whatever faith, true faith is the ability to question comfortably and to doubt and to reanalyze.
And if you think about it, there's a lot more, I suppose, personal and mental and emotional strength in being able to doubt, because humans do not like to live in a state of doubt. They like to be definite about things. And this is the sort of thing you can't be definite about. It has to be very personal. So being able to admit the presence of doubt and making yourself as comfortable with it as possible, and yet continuing to question yourself, shows a lot more strength of character, I think.
Hmm.
In my opinion.
Very interesting discussion. Tell us your thoughts, listeners. Have you read any interesting Christian fantasy or speculative fiction or historical fiction? Do you agree with us? Do you disagree with us? What are your thoughts? Leave us a comment, and thanks for listening.
Thanks, and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.